coalition, on the other hand, has also used the tanker to implement its own agenda, despite greater dangers that also threatening the Suez Canal.
The delay of the maintenance operation, as well as the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi coalition, has led to an oil derivative crisis from which Yemenis have been suffering for months. This has also reflected negatively the health sector.
Experts confirm that the sinking of the reservoir will cause an environmental catastrophe from which Yemen will not recover for more than 30 years until it gets rid of the dire consequences of contamination. The crisis will also cause the extinction of millions of marine life from the Red Sea. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a, Yemen.
Allah. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. Stay tuned.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, and we'd like to start by giving you our condolences, first and foremost, to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and then secondly to the nation, the noble nation, and the people of Iran, and thirdly to all the revolutionaries who are out there at the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, who was a great hero for everyone, and not just even revolutionaries. We have to say that he was a great hero for the camp of the oppressed. And we're going to be discussing about why he was assassinated today. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi from the Caribbean, and we have Sheikh Ali from the US and a deaf to America. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So I'd like to open up the discussion. I mean, I know that emotions are very high one day, and it's strange as well. Sometimes you feel very happy, sometimes you feel very sad. It's a strange feeling that not only myself, but I think a lot of people are going through right now. And I'd like to start the discussion by asking, why did they assassinate, why did they target our great general?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in ar-rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My condolences and also congratulations to the Muslim Ummah, the nation of Iran. Above that, all the Maraji and the Islamic jurists of the Islamic world, and Rahbar Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who is the leader of the Muslim Ummah. Not to mention the heart of the Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, would be aggrieved right now. It would be sad right now to see that one of his loyal and faithful commander, a general, somebody who stood up for the cause of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, got ruthlessly martyred as a result of an airstrike, a drone strike by the great Satan America, the Pharaoh of the time. And if we look at the reasons of the enmity and hatred towards General Qasem Soleimani, which we will be discussing in this program, It will be very clear, it will be crystal clear for our listeners why he was targeted. And the biggest reason, in my opinion, is his standing up and standing tall against the Pharaoh and the Yazid and the Nimrud of the time, America, and foiling so many of America's plots in this region,
right,
throughout the West Asia region, sometimes referred to as Middle East. All of their plans and plots, they were foiled. They were actually, they went bad, and they were made to fail because of the strategic planning and the courage of this great martyr, Shahid Qasem Soleimani. Along with him, I would like also to mention the martyrdom and the shahadat of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was a great commander from the Iraqi side, and he was also resisting against the American hegemony in the region, especially in Iraq, and his role has been detrimental for American plans and American plots in the region, and he was with General Qasem Soleimani the day he was martyred,
right,
as a result of this airstrike. So we will talk more about the reasons later down the line, but our condolences and at the same time, our congratulations.
Yeah.
Why do we congratulate?
That's why I wanted to ask. I mean,
right? Now, we need to understand what shahadat means, what martyrdom means in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of shahadat in this movement, in this entire divine movement of the Anbiya, the prophets, and the awliya and awsiya of prophets, and also the imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam? What does shahadat and martyrdom hold? It has a very high value in Islam, especially the Islam of Ahlul Bayt. If you know, 11 of our imams are martyred, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever thought, why were they martyred?
Right.
What is it that they were doing? What wrong did they do to the people of that time? Well, as we know that they were the perfect manifestation of the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which means that they did not do anything wrong, then why were they martyred? Well, the primary reason was because they stood up against the oppressors of their time. They
right.
challenged the status quo.
Yeah.
They challenged the hegemony of the oppressors and the evil powers of their time. And as a result, they were martyred. This martyrdom is nothing new for us. And this is something which is a source of pride for us, that we will keep working for the cause, the divine cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We will keep working for the rights of the average and normal human beings living in different countries, all the oppressed. We will keep standing up for their rights, for their natural rights as a human being. And as a result of that, if the enemy of humanity, they want to take us out, so be it.
Bring it on.
Right? And
right.
this is something that the enemy fears the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They know that this person, he is uncontrollable. Hence, what are they left with? The only option that they have is to take him out, to kill him.
Yeah.
Right? And this is where a shaheed, he gets to his destination that he has been wanting to get to for the longest time. Same thing you see in Shahid Qasem Soleimani. If you look at the video footages that are available out there on the internet, you know, although they're being blocked by the mainstream social media, and the mainstream media is not even showing those, but you look at that urge of shahada, the urge of martyrdom, and this is where Imam Ali alayhi salam, let me take you back in the history. When he got martyred, what did he say? At the time of his martyrdom, he's saying, after he got struck, Fustu bi Rabbil Ka'ba.
Fustu bi Rabbil Ka'ba.
Right? This means that today I have become successful by the Lord. You know, he swears by the Lord.
Mm.
By Allah, today I've become successful.
Allah.
So all of those accomplishments that Imam Ali alayhi salam had throughout his life, they're on one side. But when it comes to martyrdom, this is when that final statement comes out, that today I have been successful. So we can very comfortably say that today Shahid Qasem Soleimani became successful in the real sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And this is where we congratulate the entire Muslim Ummah that we are continuing this legacy of martyrdom.
Before we I wanted to ask you about this, why he was assassinated. Before we come to that, though, Sayyid Mahdi, if you could, what's your take on this whole balance between the tabriq and the tasliyat? Like, what you congratulate people and you give them felicitations at the same time as you give them condolences. Why?
Right. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. I'd like to start in this same token, of course, condolences on the martyrdom, the shahadat of Haj Qasem Soleimani. And again, congratulations, especially on the pure soul of Major General Qasem Soleimani, for attaining his lifelong desire to attain martyrdom. In one of the quotes from him, he says that I have searched mountains and valleys for martyrdom, but I have yet to gain it.
Right.
And so, again, congratulations on him for attaining this lifelong desire to reach a martyrdom, which, of course, is not a blessing that everyone can achieve. I think Sheikh Ali quite eloquently, you know, put it into perspective. Of course, on one side, you do have this feeling of happiness that, you know, we have achieved martyrdom. And as he said, of course, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he attains martyrdom, he says that finally I have been victorious. Martyrdom, right, being this sacrifice of yourself, of your loved ones, mm-hmm. of whatever you have for the sake of the victory of the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a very divine and a very great position. It's a very great status. Of course, it is not given to those who are unworthy. But at the same time, of course, there is this feeling of pain and sadness when you lose a loved one, when you lose somebody who is very special. And as we will, you know, talk about in our various programs on Qasim Soleimani, he was truly loved by the people. He was greatly admired and respected even by his enemies and his foes. And so, you know, this does cause a pain and sadness and grief among countless people all across the world.
This is the voice of Shahid Qasim Soleimani, along with the English translation of his words.
فوست به رب الکعبه رستگار شدم رستگار شدم پیروز شدم من رسیدم من بردم
By the Lord of Kaaba I become prosperous. Prosperity means becoming victorious, reaching the goals and winning everything.
Welcome back to the studio. So this culture of martyrdom is definitely an inherent part of Islamic culture and the Islamic civilization and an Islamic society where we actually glorify those who have given their lives in the way of Allah. Obviously, the Quran, we have the verse of the Quran which says, لَا تَحْسَبَنَّ الَّذِينَ قُتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَمْوَاتًا بَلْ أَحْيَاءٌ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ يُرْزَقُونَ. Do not think of those who are slain in the way of Allah as dead. Rather, they are alive and they are sustained with their Lord. Now, it's funny because as Iran has responded to, well, at least done an initial kind of response, an initial slap to the enemies, to America, to the base in Iraq. And it's really funny to see how American politicians are scrambling, how they've created a media blackout, and they're trying to stop anybody from finding out how much damage we've actually done to them. They're terrified. And it reminds you of what happened back in 2006 when Hezbollah was facing Israel. They killed a few of the Zionists and they all scattered because giving their lives in their cause is nothing but greed and shame. So they don't have that passion of giving their lives or even fighting for that cause, whereas we have a solid, like, culture of martyrdom. Now, I'd like to ask this question. We don't have that much time left. Why? Why did they do this, and what was that all about? Why?
Right. So, we'll see. There are two sides of this coin, right? One is from the side of the General Qasim Soleimani and the likes. Why did they do what they did? And then the other side of the coin is what the enemies did and why did they do it? So, on this side, you know, the Quran is already telling us how the believers are, right? Mm-hmm. As we see that in chapter 33 of Quran, verse number 23, it says, among the believers are men, true to what they promised Allah.
Subhanallah.
Among them is he who has fulfilled his vow, and among them is he who awaits. Mm-hmm. So, see, if you look at this verse, it's already informing us that there are those men of Allah, the Rijalullah, who are ready to sacrifice all they have for this cause, for this movement, for the divine principles of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of Islam, to accomplish that justice-based society in the world. And on the other hand, again, you know, the Quran informs us that there are the Fir'auns of the time, the Pharaohs. They are going to be standing up against these men of Allah. Mm-hmm. So there is going to be that fight between the right and the wrong, the righteousness and the falsehood. Now, what General Qasem Soleimani did was, you know, just a quick recap from 1980s, right? Right after the revolution, when Iran got attacked by the world powers through Saddam at the time, through Iraq, they attacked Iran. So General Qasem Soleimani, he had a very positive and a very strong role in that sacred defense. Uh-huh. So he fought that battle. He was there, right? And we're talking like, what, 40 years ago? Correct? 40 years ago, he was doing what he was doing today, mm-hmm. just at a different scale. He gave America and its allies and its stooges tough time back in the day.
Right.
So they had been holding that grudge against General Qasem Soleimani, and he was on their target list all this time. Then in 2006 and 2008, you know, there were wars when Israel, the Zionist regime, attacked Palestine and Gaza, and then, you know, Lebanon as well. So when they attacked them, Qasem Soleimani actually went and worked with Hezbollah to do what? To push Israel back and defend Palestine and Lebanon both.
And they gave them a damn good thrashing
right
back then.
Now, then after the victory of the believers in that war, comes the ISIS. It was another pawn of America created to, you know, create, you know, disorder in this region and unrest in this region, planting bombs, you know, killing innocent people, kidnappings, all kinds of bad things, you know, even demolishing the religious sites,
mm-hmm.
You know, all in the name of quote-unquote jihad.
Yeah.
So this fake jihad actually got uprooted, completely annihilated through who? By Qasem Soleimani.
Who's doing real jihad.
He was doing the real jihad, right? Now, America is seeing all this, and you can well see that they spent millions and billions on it,
mm-hmm.
to all these plans to succeed. But General Qasem Soleimani, who was, of course, working under the leadership of Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Muslim Ummah, he foiled those plans. So, you know, at a surface level, I think this should suffice for our listeners to understand
right.
that why was he targeted, what was the reason behind his assassination, and what did America want to accomplish?
Dear listeners, Qasem Soleimani was a thorn in the side of the enemies, and that is pretty much why. They just could not bear it, and they wanted to send shivers of fear into the Ummah and warn others who want to resist against them. But all it has done is backfired, and now the resistance has only grown. Inshallah, we'll see you next time.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with the massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief. including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. And it's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The running foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a U.S. company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار قرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the US fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed, and after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again, the one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Day of insight and allegiance with leader. On 30th of December 2009, corresponding to the 9th of the Iranian month of Day, 1388, the Iranian nation created a glorious epic, a multi-million-strong epic in support of the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. This great day was a day of re-allegiance of the Ummah with the leader, and it remained like a golden chapter in the history of the Islamic Revolution. This day has been named as a day of insight and allegiance with leader, Ayatollah Khamenei said on this day. If this nation prostrates hundreds of times as a sign of gratitude for the bounty of this day, it still won't be enough. On such a day, which this year falls on 29th of December due to it being a leap year, millions of Iranians poured onto the streets of Tehran and other Iranian cities. In a spontaneous show of support for the Islamic Revolution, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and their religious beliefs. After the presidential election in 2009 in Iran, the defeated presidential candidate suggested that the election had been rigged and that there has been widespread election fraud. It is astounding that even before the votes were counted, one of the candidates claimed victory at the ballot box, saying the election would have no winner except him. This pre-planned scenario caused unrest in big cities, especially in Tehran, and little by little resulted in vandalism and riots in different parts of the capital, and this continued for almost 8 months. The defeated candidate, along with a few of his cohorts, issued several statements claiming that a great voter fraud had taken place and that the election should be nullified, though the failed candidate failed to produce a single piece of evidence or document to back up his claims. Thus, they fanned the flames of street rioting and called on youth to pour onto the streets and chant slogans against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic system. In the heat of these events, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei invited young people and the people to be insightful and recognize the hidden hands of the enemies behind the scenes. Then US President Barack Obama used to send provocative messages to youth, calling the seditionist instigators as the Iranian nation. The arch enemy of the Iranian nation, the child killer regime in Tel Aviv, together with its comrades in crime in Europe, especially Britain, were soon declaring their support for the rioters. With the heated-up provocation of the Western media and the direction of domestic hypocrites, the issue of vote rigging in the election was used to target the very Islamic system and its sacred ideals. The slogans changed so that instead of the deeply rooted slogan in support of occupied Palestine and the Palestinian cause, there could be heard slogans against Islam and against the Palestinian cause. This small group, which was clearly being directed from overseas, had indeed targeted the very identity of the Islamic system and the Islamic Revolution. As the sinister goals of the rioters were revealed, the Iranian nation became aware of the plots of the enemies and understood that the sworn enemies of the Islamic Revolution had planned serious schemes for overthrowing the system and defeating the revolution. In addition, the leader of the Islamic Revolution did his best to awaken the rioters on the one hand and dissuade the heads of seditionists, the defeated presidential candidates and his accomplices, to return to the nation and to repent for their sins. However, none of these people accepted the leader's fatherly advice and continued their seditionist remarks and moves. The climax of disrespect to the Islamic sanctities took place in the Islamic month of Muharram, particularly on the 10th day of Muharram, the day of Ashura, when several mourning gatherings and placards and mosques were set on fire to further lay bare the real face of the instigators and the rioters. Therefore, the Iranian nation took decisive action and stood up against the seditionists and rioters in a massive turnout. On 30th of December 2009, just in Tehran, over 5 million people took to the streets to show their stalwart support for the Islamic Revolution and their disgust at the rioters and those who had disrespected Islamic sanctities. The nationwide turnout of the Iranian people on 30th of December 2009 was so massive that it was a pure show of support in defense of Islam, in defense of the Islamic system and the leader of the Islamic Revolution. As a matter of fact, the progressive principle of Velayat-e Faqih, or the rule of the supreme jurisprudent, which currently is manifested by the leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is the main pillar of the Islamic Revolution. The Iranian people have on many occasions seen the Islamic Revolution move through turbulent crises under the wise leadership and navigation of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. During the past four decades, they have passed these crises with flying colors. They know it well that any measure to undermine the status of the leadership is tantamount to undermining the authority of the infallible imams. And obedience of the leader is equal to obedience of God, the Prophet of Islam, and the infallible Imam's blessings of God upon them. He is the guide towards sublimity and advancement within framework of Islamic laws. The bond of the people with such a leader is an ideological bond which has its roots in their hearts. The rioters and their masters overseas thought in vain that they could weaken this bond with rabble-rousing and obfuscating the climate, but quite opposite in fact. Their wishful thinking never materialized. The Iranian people revised their allegiance with the leader of the Islamic Revolution and showed their firm and unflinching support for Islam and the Islamic Revolution. And the ideals of the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. On 30th of December 2009, the Iranian nation proved that the Velvet Revolutions will not work in Iran as long as they march in the footsteps of their leader. The color revolutions of Michael Ledeen, James Sharp, and George Soros will not be effective in Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "You saw that sedition was kicked up, some works were done, efforts were made, America defended the seditionists and rioters, Britain defended the rioters, the Western powers, hypocrites, and kingdom-seeking defended. But what was the result? The result was that against its magnitude of unblessed unity and convergence, our dear people, our great nation, on 30th of December, 9th of day, on the 22nd of Bahman, 11th of February, demonstrated such a greatness that has astounded the world."
For months now, the Iraqi government, along with Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or the PMU, has been warning that Daesh is exploiting the coronavirus epidemic in the war-torn country and the rising conflict there to resurge. Daesh attacks have now been on the rise for several months. According to Daya al-Assadi, an Iraqi politician and former member of parliament, people are talking not only about ISIS, but a new version that might arise now. These fears were enhanced after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, on January 3, 2020. On January 20th, in fact, shortly after the assassination, the United Nations sent a report to the UN Security Council warning it that Daesh had begun to reassert itself in both Iraq and Syria through increasingly bold attacks. Later in 2020, the Under Secretary General of the United Nations Office of Counterterrorism, Vladimir Voronkov, told the Security Council that measures to minimize the spread of COVID-19, such as lockdowns and restrictions on movement, seem to have reduced the risk of terrorist attacks in many countries.
The COVID-19 crisis has highlighted the challenges we face in eliminating the threat of terrorism. ISIL and other terrorist groups seek to exploit the far-reaching disruption and negative socio-economic and political impact of the pandemic.
It seems that this is nowhere more prevalent than in Western Asia, Syria, and Iraq.
At the start of the year, we have seen contrasting regional disparities in the threat trajectory. In conflict zones, the threat has increased, as evidenced by ISIL's regrouping and increasing activity in Iraq and the Syrian Arab Republic, and among some of its regional affiliates.
Daesh emerged from the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a local offshoot of Al-Qaeda founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2004. The group changed its name to ISIS or Daesh in 2013. Daesh launched an offensive on Iraq's Mosul and Tikrit in June 2014. On June 29th, Daesh leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced the formation of a so-called caliphate, stretching from Aleppo in Syria to Diyala in Iraq. Then in 2014, Iraq's most senior Shia cleric issued a call to arms after Daesh seized Iraqi cities. The call by a representative of Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali al-Sistani in the holy city of Karbala. After the call, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis took up arms and joined what is now known as the PMU. These same forces believe that the U.S. was behind Daesh all along. According to Muhammad Mahdi al-Bayati, a leader in Iraq's Badr organization, which is part of the country's popular mobilization forces, said that eyewitnesses living along the border with Syria have informed security officials that American forces are conducting extensive airborne transfers of Daesh terrorists from Syria to Iraq. PMU forces revealed fresh attempts by Washington and Saudi Arabia to facilitate the return of fugitive Daesh militants to Iraq. Back in May of this year, at least 10 members of the PMU, better known by their Arabic name Hashdul Sha'bi, were killed in a coordinated attack carried out by Daesh in Iraq's north-central province of Salahuddin. A senior commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit says the recent Daesh attacks on PMU positions are part of a U.S. plot to extend the American troops' presence in Iraq. In 2018, Yeni Shafak, a Turkish daily newspaper, quoting sources, reported on that there had been many cases of U.S. forces directly delivering material and technical assistance to Daesh militants in the town of Al-Mansura, which is located in the northern Syrian province of Raqqa. In fact, the U.S. has long been accused of supporting terrorism in the region. WikiLeaks exposed an email from Jake Sullivan in 2012 who was deputy chief of staff deputy to ex-secretary of state Hillary Clinton during former U.S. President Barack Obama's tenure, informing her that al-Qaeda is on America's side in Syria. Jake Sullivan has been recently nominated as national security advisor by U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. Even U.S. President Donald Trump, during his campaign for the presidency in 2016, admitted that the U.S. government is responsible for the rise of Daesh.
It was Hillary Clinton that she should get an award from them as the founder of ISIS. That's what it was. That's what it was. Her weakness. Her weak policies.
A few days later in 2016, Trump doubled down on his claims that the U.S. created the Daesh terrorist group.
In many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Earlier this year, after the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guards Corps, IRGC, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the PMU's second-in-command, the Iraqi parliament has voted to remove U.S. troops from Iraq. On May 1st, several Daesh units launched a coordinated advance against members of the Iraqi state-supported Popular Mobilization Unit, PMU, north of Baghdad. These complex and coordinated attacks are indications of an organization that is winning back real power. According to the United Nations in 2010, before Daesh began its big rise in 2013 and 2014, it had around 700 militants available. Today, Daesh has 2,000 to 3,000 militants in Iraq and Syria each, and that shows the danger they pose. U.S. Special Envoy for the so-called Global Coalition to Defeat IS, James Jeffrey, speculated that the militia had between 14,000 and 18,000 militants in Syria and Iraq. But the U.S., on the other hand, is fighting the same groups that rid Iraq of Daesh. Earlier this year, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had warned Iraqi President Barham Saleh that Washington was ready to shut its diplomatic mission in Baghdad and take action against anti-terror resistance groups. The decision to close the embassy in Baghdad is in President Trump's hands and is ready. If our forces withdraw and the embassy is closed in this way, we will liquidate all those who have been proven to have been involved in these attacks, Pompeo said in a letter delivered to the Iraqi president. Perhaps the U.S. is orchestrating another rise for Daesh as it plans in the region once again fail due to the vigilance of the people. After all, Daesh rose in Iraq shortly after the U.S. was forced to leave Iraq by 2011 because Washington couldn't reach an agreement with Baghdad over that issue. And now as the U.S. is getting ready to leave once again from Iraq, and this time for good, Daesh seems to be resurging. Is there a connection? Only time can tell.
IRIB English Radio.